Now it's my very great pleasure on the program to introduce the gentleman who was responsible for writing both the book and the lyrics of The Fantastics, and it's an off-Broadway living legend, the one and only Tom Jones. Hello, Tom.
Yes, the one and only Tom Jones. There is another Tom Jones out there, but his name isn't really Tom Jones, actually.
Exactly. So you're the genuine Tom Jones.
Yes. Well, you know, The Fantastics, I just thought about it the other day. I think in these 60 years, this during the middle of this pandemic, is the first time in 60 years that The Fantastics isn't playing somewhere or lots of places.
Indeed.
So it's a kind of a strange feeling for me, you know?
Yes.
you get used to that happening. When it originally ran in the original theater, it ran for 42 years and then closed, and that was a big surprise after living with it in the theater. And Harvey, the composer, and I did all the casting and, gave notes and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
But then it only closed for 4 years and then reopened and ran another 10 years. So,
Yes, indeed.
I'm used to having it around, and it's strange not to be out there someplace.
And a gentleman who had a great belief in the musical was your original producer, Laurie Noto, and I believe with the original reviews that they weren't particularly promising, but Laurie decided to keep the show running.
Yes, on the original, you talked to Rita, she probably told you this, but on the opening night in 1960, we got the first notices in, and they were not bad at all, but they were not great.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an unknown show, and a lot of the people there, the so-called knowledgeable people, advised our producer, Laurie Noto, to close it that night because they said he could save a week's salary.
Yes.
And but he was very determined, and he believed in it completely, and he put his life savings, which were very modest. In fact, the show only it cost $15,000 to produce, and actually came in opened for $12,500.
Mm-hmm.
But so he stuck it out, and we suffered through the first summer with very small houses, but then it suddenly turned around. In September, when people came back into the city from the summer, and it struggled along and did pretty well. And then there was a production of Hallmark Hall of Fame with Burt Lahr and Stanley Holloway and other names.
Yes.
In it. And after that, it was sold out for 10 solid years. And then it sort of leveled off, doing reasonably well and making a profit, but not selling out except on weekends. And that lasted for the next, 20 years or something.
Yes. Yes, I believe the original off-Broadway production ran a total of 42 years and 17,162 performances, making it the world's longest-running musical.
Yes. Well, The longest running show is The Mousetrap,
yes,
as you know, in London, which has been going, I think, since Queen Victoria's time, practically, you know. But that is a phenomenon indeed. But the phenomenon's primarily located in London. The Fantastics was and has been, except for this pandemic, produced in many. It's been in, I believe, Music Theater told me it's been produced in 62 different countries.
Mm-hmm.
And I know in the United States it's had like almost 20,000 productions. So it's been a wonderful thing for us, for me and my family to. For sure.
Indeed, yes. It first came out to Australia here in a production by, what became our Melbourne Theatre Company back in October of 1962, and was quite popular for the limited run that it played here.
Yes, but yeah, there have been a lot of star production. There were some Robert Goulet at the 30th anniversary did a big tour.
Yes.
In the original production, I don't know if Law and Order has been as popular in Australia.
Oh, certainly. Yes, 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 it has indeed been. Yep.
Because Jerry Orbach, who was that was his first big break in New York, and he was the original El Gallo narrator in the show.
Yes.
And then he went on to, of course, many wonderful Broadway shows as well, and then into the television world with Law and Order, and a lot of other people. Yeah, I don't know if you know Kristen Chenoweth.
Certainly, yes, indeed. Yep.
Yeah, she. That was her first show, and Murray Abraham. I don't know if you remember him. He got the Oscar for playing an Amadeus.
That's correct. Yes, indeed.
He played the old actor, which was the part that I played originally,
mm-hmm.
and that was his first show in New York. A lot of people came along. There wasn't much salary with the Fantastics, a small off-Broadway theater.
Mm-hmm.
But so a lot of people came and got their first shot at it, you know. And then also a lot of people, Glenn Close and others, did it in college when they were students.
Yes.
And then people did it on tour. Well, Elliot Gould and Liza Minnelli did, in fact, I think the very first tour of the Fantastics when she was just 17 years old.
Okay. So quite a few famous people have appeared in the Fantastics over the years. I believe that you and Harvey first met when you were students at the University of Texas, and you were...
That is correct, yes. Mm-hmm. We did our first musical together was in 1950. That was a college musical, right, 10 years before the Fantastics. And then neither of us intended to write musicals or to be writers. Harvey was a very, very successful illustrator, one of the top in America, and I had hoped to be a theatrical director, but nobody ever hired me. When we did the musical, college musical together, it was such a revelation to me because I had been in the theater department for years and years and years, two college degrees as an actor and a director, but we never did any musicals. They were considered too frivolous.
Yes.
But I was really blown away by the opportunities they had to, like, do linguistic, to do sort of magical things with language and to use presentational things, so like to acknowledge the presence of the audience, you know.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Speaking directly to the audience, indeed. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so our whole career has been, my career has been and continues to be, even though Harvey retired, Harvey Schmidt, the composer, we worked together for 50 years, but he retired, and then sadly he passed on 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I've continued and continue to write with younger writers, and also with Offenbach, who's not that young, actually. but a wonderful partner. He absolutely gives me no problems whatsoever.
Yes.
You know, and he's very generous with his share of the royalty. You know. So, but anyway, I mean, the thing I'm working on now is a musical version of The Tempest called La Tempesta.
Okay, right. Uh-huh.
And I will just do a little short bit, if I may.
Oh, certainly.
Of the very first thing when Prospero comes out into an empty blank stage and he says to the audience, "I draw a magic circle in the sand like this," and he does. "I touch the circle and it turns to light like this."
Mm-hmm.
"It's filled with possibility, a journey of discovery, but only if we both believe that this can be true, for the secret of the magic lies not just in the magician, but also inside you. And that's been the kind of premise of the work that I've done most of the time, is to try to do shows in which the audience can help create it by using their imaginations and by acknowledging right away we're all in a theater, we're doing a show, and they're there to help create it, you know?
Yes. Well, I guess that template goes back to Shakespeare's days with, you know, the Globe Theatre and with the prologue to Henry V especially, where he invites the audience to use their imaginations in this wooden O. And then
Henry V, actually.
Yeah.
I actually, in the right after that speech that I told you, then I actually steal a line or two, because then I'll just do a couple of more lines. Then he starts to sing. He says, I ask you now on this bare stage to create an enormous storm. I ask you when I speak of lightning to see it slice the night. One or two passing shadows must you turn into a fleet. And that's all just paraphrasing the chorus for First Speech in Henry V, actually.
Indeed. Yes. Is that a great influence for you, the works of Shakespeare?
Absolutely. I mean, it's much more than musical theater, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't really grow up around... I mean, grew up... was born and raised in a small ranching community in West Texas, and there was absolutely no theater whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, we did have the movies and everything, but when I went to college and started studying, there was a great British director named B. Iden Payne,
mm-hmm.
who had headed the theater at Stratford and Avon, and who had had an extraordinary... He was an old gentleman, but a wonderful teacher. He had given John Barrymore his first serious role and things like that, you know?
Yes.
So we've studied Shakespeare under him and were in productions that he directed. And he also then had in... He started the repertory theater up again in England at the Manchester Rep in the 1910 or something.
Yes.
He had done there in Regent's Park in London. He had done a production of this play, obscure play by Edmond Rostand called Les Romanesques.
Mm-hmm.
The British writer, a translator of it, called it The Fantastics. So it was because of Mr. Payne and his background and the background of the of Shakespeare and also of the Fantastics that we wound up doing this piece.
Yes, indeed.
You know, I'm sorry, I've never been to Australia. I always wanted to go. One of my sons has been there a number of times with his band.
Okay.
That he's...
Uh-huh.
Yeah, a rock band that they've toured Australia quite a few times.
Ah, great.
Interestingly, here's a little story. His band is called Holy Ghost.
Yes.
And my wife and I went down to Brooklyn to see him and the band and the nice big crowd and, you know, a rock. And I thought, my God, my son Sam is here and I'm here and the band is here. It Father, Son, and Holy Ghost at a rock concert in Brooklyn. And I expected the skies to open like an Angels in America, you know, and for the angel to come crashing through into the concert.
Oh, great. quite poetic indeed, yes. As indeed the Fantastics is, that poetic language obviously came very easily to you, both in the blank verse and also in the poetic imagery in the songs.
Well, you know, another thing that's kind of interesting about the Fantastics, when I was writing the libretto, the book, and the lyrics, I was also doing a lot of study on my own, long after college, after the Army and everything, about some of the things that Shakespeare did and trying to learn from him. And one of the things that I discovered from a book called Shakespeare's Imagery, is that he used a thematic coloring when working on each play without a big thing, but it just sort of subtly under there.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain plays, for example, in Macbeth, the images of darkness are constantly running throughout. And so I decided to seek for an image, a color, a palette for the Fantastics.
Yes.
And I decided that the changing of the seasons and would be it. And, of course, then we were lucky enough to come up with the song Try to Remember, which is about the changing of the seasons from autumn into the memories in December. Deep in December, it's nice to remember without a hurt, the heart is hollow, for example.
Yes.
But throughout the Fantastics, it's all about vegetation and about the changing of the season. And that was it's a sort of thing that people don't ever, and rightfully, don't think about it or don't notice, but it does help give it a texture that is interesting, and in some instances, it gives it a texture that's different somehow from most musicals. I mean, the Fantastics, it sounds the way I'm talking as if it's like deep and everything. It's not, but it's a fun, light spoof, but it does have this other undercurrent. And for example, I'll quote you at the very end when the narrator, Elgio, Jerry Orbach,
mm-hmm.
says, "There is a curious paradox that no one can explain who understands the secret of the reaping of the grain, who understands why spring is born out of winter's laboring pain, or why we all must die a bit before we grow again." Again, that's the seasonal thing, but again, it's touching on things. Then one of the reasons I think the Fantastics has run so long, I mean, it's fun, that's the main reason.
Yes.
And it engages the audience to help participate. And the score, Harvey's music is beautiful and fun. But there is also, it can be taken on different levels, and one of them is this sort of what they used to call John Barleycorn, out of darkness or out of death, life and renewal of hope.
Yes.
And we could use a little renewal of hope right now.
Indeed. And I guess that changing of the seasons also carries over into the satirical song that you have the two fathers sing, "Plant a radish, get a radish, you know what you're about."
Yes, right. There's so many songs. And, of course, particularly the opening song, Try to Remember, which is very specifically a song about the change of seasons and sort of sums up in the opening what the show is about.
Indeed, and I guess at the time that you and Harvey were writing it, you didn't realize that you had a hit on your hands that would be recorded by so many artists over the years.
No, it's a wonderful, wonderful surprise, really. And the first person to ever record it was Harry Belafonte, who has recorded it five different times in different versions. And towards the latter part, he records it with him and a young man. So this the two voices and sort of like contrapuntally, again, like September and December, like side by side.
Indeed, yes. The older man looking back on his youth, yeah.
Yes, right. Mm-hmm. Placido Domingo also did that when he did a recording of it, but I think he probably got the idea from Belafonte.
Yes, yes. And you also had to amend one of the songs because you use rape in a rather light-hearted fashion from the Latin, but then you thought, well, that might be a bit controversial, so you also had an alternate song.
Yes, yes. No, I'm so glad we finally were able to get rid of that. I wanted to, That was in the original play, the translation that we did. So we didn't think a thing about it, and nobody ever thought anything about it. But gradually, as the show began to run and our consciousness began to be raised, I thought, my God, this isn't funny. We should not be getting humor from this.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to take it out, and the producer said he refused. And but eventually we were able to do it, and now we have, redid the lyrics, same music, and it works just great without that. And I'm so happy to go to my grave without that, with that change having been made. You know, I mean,
mm-hmm. Indeed.
I'm not happy to go to my grave, but if I do have to go to my grave, I'm glad we got that fixed before I go, you know.
Exactly. And I guess the stage musical being one which works on the audience's imagination so much, then in filmic terms, the 1995 film where you have to present everything in a realistic sense didn't really quite work. Did you have any input into the film version?
Oh, no, it really doesn't work. It doesn't work. I mean, because this is very specifically a theatrical matter. If people do the show the right, and if we do it right and get the right balance and everything, we have a cardboard moon that we hang up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if we do it right, by the end of it, you believe that it's real, you know?
Yes.
But that's part of the excitement of it. We have a man dressed like from the Oriental Theater, what they call the Invisible Prop Man, dressed in black. He stands in at one point, then he sprinkles the young boy and girl with a little bit of white confetti, and you believe it's snow. You know, it's clearly a theatrical magic. And the minute you kind of like give them a house with dishes to wash and stuff like that, It's not that kind of piece, really.
Yes,
and
yes.
So we had a wonderful adaptation that would have taken care of that, and we had a great director. I don't know if you are familiar with the wonderful opera director Jean-Pierre Ponelle, who's like very, very influential worldwide, and Milano and the Metropolitan everywhere, with very exciting, very daring productions.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes.
We saw some of his work on film, and we invited him to come when he was doing something at the Metropolitan Opera, and he came down to our little theater, and he completely got it. And so we were like, worked with him, and he had a film company, but the film company that he was backed him was only was interested in opera, was not interested in what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went to the studios, they were only interested in, like, they were not interested in this sort of opera approach.
Yes.
The approach that we had was very similar to, and perhaps even, you might say, stolen from, the Ingmar Bergman's thing of the Magic Flute. I don't know if you ever saw that film.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's where he starts in a theater, and then you move into a world that is part real and part theater. That actually happens in the film of Olivier's film of
Henry V. Indeed,
too.
Yes.
It starts at the Old Globe, and then you gradually move into a world that's almost like real, but isn't, you know?
Yes, yes, indeed. Have there ever been any video productions of the play just as the Fantastics is presented on stage?
No, a video production.
Yeah.
No, you know, there was, in 1963, there was this production that was done on television, but
abbreviated, yes.
With the Hallmark Hall of Fame, with the Ricardo Montalban and, as I say,
Bert Lahr and Stanley Holloway, yes.
Stanley Holloway and John Davidson and Susan Watson. And they were all lovely, but that was a one-hour version, and it didn't deal in any way with any of this, the things that make
the theatricality
unique or special to me. It was just a lovely little fairy tale. It was hugely popular, but it wasn't... I have never been eager to like have it be released again or anything, because the very essence of what we were trying to do isn't in that production at all.
Indeed. But have you thought about actually filming it in the theatre with an audience, done in its original theatrical presentation?
Yes, I don't think that would... I mean, to make a successful film of it, one should, like, find a way to combine what happens on the stage and find an equivalent to that in film.
Yes, yes.
But it certainly would involve, you know, when we did this the film version that we did, El Gallo has a couple of narrations, but they really didn't want him, the idea of an actor talking to the camera, talking directly to, they were just shocked at that, you know. They said, oh, you can't do that in film, you know.
Yes,
but
yes.
Of course, that's what you have to do, really.
Exactly.
to deal with something unique like this.
Indeed, yes.
But anyway, I mean, you know, they did, the director was a lovely man and very talented, and it was the thing that just didn't work out, and so, you know, you win a few, lose a few, but actually, I love talking about the Fantastics, but really at this point in my life, I don't spend much time thinking about the Fantastics, because I'm working on three new pieces, and I'm 92, and I'm very eager to get them finished and get them up before I depart this veil of tears and to see them come to life. But you know,
indeed.
And I'm excited about one of them is La Tempesta that I told you about.
Yes, yes.
And one of them is a stage version with lots of changes based on the film Harold and Maude.
Okay, yes.
And the third one, it's called The Game of Love, and it's based upon the Anatole plays of Arthur Schnitzler, all about the love affairs in Vienna in 1890, of this man named Anatole, and with using music by Offenbach.
Indeed, yes. Well, that's very handy. You can write your lyrics to the set music, conform to the meter of the music as it exists, so I guess that makes the job a lot easier.
Yes. Well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take advantage, since I have you as a captive audience across the ocean here.
Certainly.
I'm going to give you a little from the Game of Love, a little short part of a verse of a song, okay?
Certainly, okay.
It's a song sung by a foolish old man named Baron Diebel, and it's about ménage à trois, okay?
Yes,
and
yes.
I can't really sing, so I'll just sort of say the lines, okay?
That's fine.
And he sings, I don't care much for groups of four, any more than that I just deplore. My mother always said to me, little one, be satisfied with three. That is why I have such an aversion to anything in the least perverse. And yet, I have a little weakness, in spite of all my meekness, one tiny little weakness. Two young ladies, ooh la la, I just adore a ménage à trois. For oh, the joys that you can incur when your infatuation is triangular. And oh, the pleasures you can produce when you're the bottom of the right hypotenuse. So it was fun writing to Offenbach. It was a challenge, but great fun.
Indeed, yes, yes. And I guess speaking about your performing career, well, you were sort of thrust into a role in the Fantastics in the role of the old actor Henry, quite at the last minute.
Yes, that was, you know, that was great fun to do. And I did it, as you know, originally in 1960, and then didn't do it again for 35 years or more, until the Japanese invited us to bring in English speaking, and the Japanese at that point had so much money we were not in a position to refuse them. And then I found it to be such great fun that I came back on the 50th anniversary and played it again, which was much more age appropriate at that point.
Yes. And I guess as the years went on, you didn't have to put on quite so much makeup as you did back in 1960.
No, No, but I did, just the same. I would go in. I was like this old, old man, but I would go in and put on makeup as an old, old man. Yeah. Just we did a show called I Do, I Do.
Indeed, yes.
And it's about 50 years of marriage with the same two people in it, you know, covering all the 50 years.
Yes.
But there was a dinner theater in Minneapolis in the States where the show ran for 24 years. With the same two actors in it.
Okay, yes. And,
isn't that amazing? And the funny thing is that when they first started doing it, they had to do old makeup as they got older.
Mm-hmm.
But by the end of the run, they were having to do it the other way around, just doing younger makeup and then taking it off just as they were doing.
Indeed, yes.
When we did it, it was originally with them. Mary Martin and Robert Preston, and they both, there's a little song, and they're right before the last scene, they're in front of the audience. Again, it's that thing what I'm talking about. It's like admitting that, you know, this, actually, I Do is kind of interesting because it isn't as brazenly presentational as most of our work.
Yes.
But it's a balance because they have these realistic scenes, but in between they go down and talk to the audience, and they also do little vaudeville numbers about marriage in between scenes,
mm-hmm.
and then they before the last scene they sing a song, and then the audience watches as they change wigs and do makeup and the whole thing.
Indeed, yes, quite unique. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, thank you very much, Tom, for speaking to us here in Australia for so long.
All right. Well, listen, Rob, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And be well, okay?
Great. All the best to you in Connecticut.
All right. Thank you. Bye.
Bye for now.